Before we start, if you're enjoying these conversations, please make sure that you like or subscribe to Cleaning Up. It really helps other people to find us. Cleaning Up is brought to you by the Liebreich Foundation and the Gilardini Foundation. Hello, I'm Michael Liebreich, and this is Cleaning Up. My guest today is Alex Honnold, one of the best rock climbers in the world, and star of Free Solo, the Oscar-winning documentary about his first ever ascent of El Capitan in Yosemite without aid or ropes. He's also the founder of the Honnold Foundation, which installs solar power in disadvantaged communities around the world. Please welcome Alex Honnold to Cleaning Up. So, Alex, welcome to Cleaning Up.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
I've been really looking forward to this because it's not often that I have a fellow athlete, and you know my athletic days are long behind me. But it's great to have you here on the show.
I thought you were going to say it's not often that you have a non-expert on the show, or a non-college educated individual on the show.
Well, we'll get onto that. And I got a funny feeling that you know a lot more about these kind of solar developments and the stuff that you're doing via your foundation. Let's start with, so where are you calling in from? Where do you call home? Because you are not in that famous van of yours.
No, I'm in my home in Las Vegas, in Nevada.
Okay, Las Vegas, Nevada, with good access, obviously, to all the climbing around there. But what we should do before we really get stuck in, I'm going to ask you to describe what you do in your own words. If I use my words, first of all, I'll probably get the terminology wrong, but also the audience for Cleaning Up, some of them will know all about what you do. They're probably fanatic followers, but there'll also be quite a few, you know, climate, clean energy, sustainable finance. And they'll be like, okay, who is this guy?
So I'm Alex Honnold. I'm a professional rock climber and I climb rocks full time. I'm most well known for free soloing, which means climbing things without a rope. And I was the subject of an Academy Award winning documentary called Free Solo. So most people have heard of me through that, you know, or sort of that's probably the biggest exposure to the mainstream. But even without the free soloing, I'd still be a professional climber. I mean, I climb things with ropes, I speed climb, I do big enchainments, I do mountain traverses. I basically dabble in sort of all forms of climbing. But I focus mostly on rock climbing. I'm certainly most well known for free soloing.
Okay. And you wrote a book a bunch of years ago, yep. 2015, Alone on the Wall. And you talk about how you're kind of irritated that everybody focuses on the free soloing and doesn't quite spend as much time on the other stuff that you do.
Yeah, though I would say, I wouldn't say I'm irritated by that. I mean, it's totally understandable, especially now because post writing that book, the film came out, which then had a big theatrical run and then won an Academy Award. And so now a lot of people have just seen the film, and the film, you know, it's titled Free Solo and it focuses on free soloing. So it's totally understandable that people think that that's my focus, but it's just not. I mean, I've always considered free soloing to be sort of like my World Cup or my Super Bowl or something, you know, sort of like a few key events a year where I have sort of moments of high performance free soloing, but then I spend the bulk of my year training and practicing and just doing normal climbing with my friends. And, you know, like basically the bulk of your training volume is normal. And then occasionally you have sort of peak experiences.
So I got to confess that when Free Solo came out, I actually didn't want to watch it. And the reason was I just didn't want to put my stomach, my nerves through that. And you've actually talked about how watching yourself afterwards is worse than actually doing this stuff. So I kind of hung back.
I wouldn't say watching yourself is worse, but I would say watching other people is much worse than doing it yourself. It's always more stressful to watch somebody free soloing than to actually go free soloing yourself.
Yeah, and of course, you know, we all know the outcome. So when I told my son is 11, when I told him that I was going to be getting you onto the show, and I told him what you do, and he was like, "Wow, is he still alive?" And I'm like, "There's a clue. He's coming on Cleaning Up."
Yeah, exactly.
But I was delighted actually when I did watch it in preparation for this. I found that actually it's not nearly as scary as I thought, and it's kind of a love story. I mean, it's a love story obviously with your current wife now, Sunny, but it's also a love story between you and what you do, really. I mean, it doesn't read as just this horror story of scary moments.
No, for sure. I mean, it's a documentary. I mean, it's not supposed to be too crazy one way or another. I mean, it's just documenting my life. But yeah, I mean, you're right that it is It's funny because when the film came out, it was kind of a love story with my then girlfriend and now my wife. And actually, we just had our first child. We had a daughter 6 weeks ago. So now it's like a good happy ending to the film. It's all very, I don't know. Now the film to me feels like a snapshot of a moment in life, but life has just been carrying on since then.
Right. And it's a lot of things resonate with me. I don't do any of the crazy stuff that I used to. In fact, if you look up there, those are my skis. Those are my feet. In fact, I'm gonna, there we go. That's actually me modeling for some suntan cream. The funny thing is, of course, the suntan cream was so bad we didn't use it. We just did the
Of course.
we used something else. In fact, but that was back in my youth. But there was a lot of things as I was re reading your book. The fact that when you got started, you wanted to get a bit of attention because you think thought you might score some free climbing shoes. And I remember that time in my skiing where I was just desperate to get the jacket, and that was the main
Yeah,
thing that
exactly.
motivated
But
me.
what kind of skiing were you doing?
So I was a bump skier. I was a mogul skier, and I took that through. I actually started relatively late because I did not have. I'm not sure if we're going to have to bleep this out, but I didn't have the balls to quit Cambridge. I was studying engineering, so I didn't quit, even though I was, probably as obsessive or nearly as obsessive about skiing as you were about climbing. But I went through Cambridge. I then got a job in London, and I was obsessively skiing whenever I could. But then I actually, when I finished Cambridge, I took a couple of seasons and I skied in the Alps in Zermatt and then Val d'Isère, started competing. And got onto the British team. And at that point, I really wanted to get the team. I wanted to get the jacket. And suddenly they made it an Olympic sport. And I was the British champion. And I thought, well, it's been really weird to sort of stop now and not try and go all the way to the Olympics, which is what I did.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting.
It was, I was a people ask, oh, did you win? And I'm like, well, I was in the British team. There's a clue. But I
Yeah,
was.
exactly.
I was mid-placed. I was mid-placed. I didn't aspire to be. I'm the honest. I didn't aspire to win. I wanted to do very well. Had I done nothing but ski all my life, maybe I would have been more competitive at the top. But it was an
Well,
amazing,
and
extraordinary experience.
I'm sure going into the Olympics, you knew that you weren't world champion. You weren't I'm sure your sort of relative seed going in. So you're kind of like, oh, I'm going for the experience. This is going to be incredible. I'm representing my country, but you kind of know that I don't know, the Norwegians or whatever are going to school you. But.
Yeah, I think that's right. But what I would say is that I actually came 32nd, right, out of it was 50 or 60. And I think what would be really wrong, because people say, oh, like Eddie the Eagle, because a few 4 years before there'd been this ski jumper who was unbelievably bad and could only ever have come last. And so I think that's not appropriate to go to the Olympics and be that bad. But to go and play, aspire to place in the top half, everybody's got their goals. I would have loved to have qualified for the final top 16. I didn't manage it, but I came 32nd. And
If it makes you feel any better, my last year of competing, I did youth competitions through childhood. My last year, I qualified for youth internationals, and it was like, and that's part of what prompted me dropping out of college because I went to like youth worlds, and I was like, oh, I'll take some time off and go climbing for a bit. But I got like 40 something. I think I got totally spanked by. It's kind of the same idea where European, especially at the time, this is like 20 years ago. The European standards for indoor competition climbing were so much higher. And me coming from suburban California, I was just kind of like, oh, I'm just here for the tourism. I'm like here to visit Scotland. And I got totally spanked and was like, wow, standards are really high here. But it didn't really discourage me from going climbing for the rest of my life.
no, but I think also, I mean, it's clear from the media that you've done, and certainly for me, I was. You can compete with other people, but fundamentally, you're competing with yourself. And if you're not ready for to go for a podium in the Olympics, it doesn't mean you're wasting your time. It just means you're still trying to get a personal best, put down the run you want, do whatever. But one thing that was getting back to some of the stuff you've done, one of the things that was is very fascinating for me is that. I skied in multiple competitions, did Europa Cup, World Cup, nationals, et cetera, et cetera. The only thing I ever end up talking about these days is the Olympics. Like, you're going to be talking about free solo and free soloing, to the exclusion of some other things that you might be equally proud of. But let's get back to, so one of the things that I found fascinating, reading and watching your stuff is your attitude to risk. Because now, fast forward, I ski for fun now, but what I do for a living is climate, clean energy, sustainability, finance, et cetera, analysis and commenting. And it's all about risk. And There are different approaches in business to risk. You know, is it the precautionary principle where you try and avoid any downside of any sort, or is there a sort of nuanced approach where you look at the probabilities of things happening? And, you know, some of the things you've said about risk are really interesting. How do you see risk in your daily, you know, in what you do for a living?
Oh, it's, I mean, this is a long conversation. Depends how deeply we want to go into it. But I mean, I think the one important distinction to make just right at the very beginning is that the risks that I'm taking as a climber are physical risks. And rather than evaluating them statistically or, you know, in the ways that you would through business, a lot of it is just felt. You know, it feels scary. Like you think about certain things and you feel a pit in your stomach. You think you might, you know, go poop or something. You know, it's like it's scary. Like it elicits a physiological fear response. And so it's not so much about, you know, running statistics as does this feel too scary? You know, and it's pretty unscientific, but as you do more preparation, as you train, as you get ready in different ways, eventually things just don't feel as scary. And you might not be able to put numbers on why it's less risky now or less dangerous now, however you want to describe it, but you just feel more comfortable with it. And so, you know, you're probably more likely to succeed if you try certain things. I don't know. It's just complicated because like with all the risk taking and climbing, you never really have a data set. You know, there are no numbers to run. It's just, how do you feel about it? Do you think it's possible? I don't know. And maybe one other like sort of foundational thing to talk about with risk is something that I like to differentiate between risk and consequence, because a lot of people.
Right.
Yeah. Like when you look at a picture of free soloing, you see somebody climbing without a rope and you think that's really risky. But, you know, if you define risk as the likelihood of falling off, you know, you don't really know what the likelihood of somebody falling off is, because it totally depends on how easy or difficult the terrain is and how solid the climber is, like how competent the climber is. So, you know, what you can say when you see that picture is that it's very high consequence, because if the climber falls, they're for sure going to die. But you don't really know how risky it is. It's just very, very high consequence. And so, you know, I think that's an important distinction with free soloing, because a lot of the stuff that I free solo is akin to climbing a ladder. You know, like I'm at least as comfortable on certain styles of climbing as I would be climbing a ladder. And so there's almost no risk of falling, but it is an incredibly high consequence. Like if I did fall, I would definitely die. And so I think that's an important thing, because people just look at it and they're like, that's crazy, that's risky. They throw out a lot of different terms interchangeably, but they do mean slightly different things, and not all of them are appropriate in you know, every circumstance.
It's really fascinating, because in business, risk would be generally framed around the sort of the probability of something happening times the consequence. But of course, the consequence is, yeah, you know, that project blows up and we can't, you know, can't bring it in, and we might lose some money. But, you know, but the consequences, in a sense, there's this, you're out at the far tail of consequences, where it's like, okay, what you call it, the worst 4 years of your life and death. Whereas in business, we don't really have that. But then in climate, when you talk about climate change, there's all these people kind of trying to work out what the risks are, but the consequence potentially is, you know, the ending of civilization.
Catastrophic.
It's catastrophic. But there's another element in climate, which is also the time element. You know, you would have 4 seconds between the mistake and the consequence. But here, and this is something that one of our episodes with Johan Rockström, the planetary scientist, and he was talking about the difference between the commitment time, which in a sense is the time we could really kind of screw up, and the impact time, the consequence, might be 200, 300, 400, 500 years, might be a millennium. And so it becomes really difficult to calculate. The consequence is potentially catastrophic, but there's this kind of huge span of time, longer than the span of a human lifetime.
In some ways, that's the exact opposite of what I was just describing with taking physical risks and feeling it in your gut, like being afraid. I mean, with climate risks, it's so far removed from your personal experience that you just don't feel scared. Like you can't, I mean, obviously a lot of people working on climate experience existential dread and, you know, like feel like deep anxiety around it, but you just don't experience fear in the same way that you do with physical risks. Like if you think you're about to fall to your death or you're about to get hit by a car or those kinds of things. And I think that's part of the reason that humanity hasn't been acting on climate more aggressively, is because there's no real feeling of immediacy. There's no feeling of panic. There's no fear. even though there definitely should be.
Well, some people do feel it. There are kids who've got climate anxiety, and there's a, you know, they're getting mentally unwell. And then I guess, you know, the problem with that, I don't think that that's
That like deep anxiety, that dread is not the same as the deep fear of like the immediate fear response. You know what I mean? Like that's like existential angst where you're like, oh, I just don't know if I can live like this. But that's still different than the immediacy of like about to be hit by a car. They're different types of fear.
No, definitely. And I think that sort of deep anxiety about something that might happen, you know, decades, and by the way, most likely centuries into the future. The problem is it's incredibly disempowering because, you know, you've got to get up in the morning and actually work on climate solutions. In my world, that's how I see it, is, you know, it's kind of like, I don't want London to be underwater in how many years, or I don't want some really, really bad things to happen to civilization. But I have to use the world as it is today to try to steer the supertanker. And if I'm filled with angst and dread, and all I'm trying to do is bring down capitalism as the only solution, that doesn't feel very effective to me.
Yeah, no, I hear that. I mean, obviously I grapple with the same sorts of things. You know, I mean, I have my foundation that's supporting solar projects around the world. And in the grand scheme of things, it's a completely trivial, you know, it's an inconsequential, like tiny little grain of sand in the giant beach of human activity. But at the same time, I'm like, you know, it's worth getting out of bed. It's worth doing something useful. At least it's like my tiny personal contribution, even though, like you said, it's not even going to nudge the super tanker in a different direction, but you can at least try, you know?
Well, that makes it sound much more sort of futile than I think it probably is. But let's come on to that, because it was through climbing that you had what you have referred to as your epiphany of realizing that, you know, you live in this kind of privileged bubble, despite, perhaps you could describe it in your own words. What woke you up to environment issues?
Well, it wasn't, I mean, epiphany maybe overstates a little bit, because it was a long, slow realization, largely through different climate expeditions, particularly a few expeditions one in particular to Chad, like the center of Africa, to the middle of nowhere, like the most remote corner of Africa that you can imagine, like days of driving without roads into the middle of the desert to go climb these untouched spires. But a few different expeditions like that just sort of made me realize. And at the same time, though, I was reading a lot of nonfiction, like environmental nonfiction, and reading about global poverty, reading about energy access issues, reading about, you know, all kinds of, and sort of like history of oil, history of fossil fuels, things like that, and just kind of seeing the human energy landscape and realizing a lot of things that I had always taken for granted. You know, growing up as a suburban Californian, life is pretty easy. And then you go to other parts of the world where you're face to face with the fact that there are a billion people on Earth with no access to energy and living, you know, full rustic lifestyles, let's say. I was like, oh, this is something that's easy to completely overlook if you stay in suburban California. And so, you know, basically several years of those types of climbing trips, those types of expeditions, those types of books slowly woke me up to the fact that I should be trying to do something useful with my life. And that sort of gave birth to the foundation over time.
And you chose a very specific thing, which is solar projects for disadvantaged communities. Why did you light on that versus all the other things that you could potentially have done?
Yeah, I sort of settled on that over time. And part of it was because I was looking, you know, I personally care about the environment more than anything else. You know, I'm an outdoors person. I'm climbing outside all the time. So I care about the environment. I care about climate. But I also recognize that there's no real point in supporting environmental projects that don't also improve standard of living, that don't help human communities in those regions. Because like through traveling for expeditions, you see, you know, villages and things where people will cut down the last tree on earth if it means boiling water for their family to eat, you know, and that's totally appropriate. That makes total sense. But, you know, my takeaway from that is that there's no point in protecting the forest if you're not improving the quality of life for the people that live near the forest, let's say. And so it's like, there's no real point in protecting nature if you're not helping the people that live near natural areas. It's like, you know, people have to be lifted out of poverty to some extent, or else like they just don't care about environmental issues. And so, you know, I was looking for environmental projects that also improved standard of living. And then I've always been drawn to, you know, when I started the foundation, I was just Googling things and just looking for projects that seemed inspiring in the right ways and just kind of like looking around. And I've always been drawn to projects that feel very win-win, like things that where you're like, this is an obvious solution. Like, why isn't this being done? And there were always many different solar projects like that. Like one of the first organizations I supported is called Grid Alternatives. They're like a national nonprofit in the US, and they do solar installations for low-income families with this job training component. So they're basically taking people that need jobs, teaching them how to become solar installers while installing solar on low-income families. So it's like basically everybody's winning from it. I'm kind of like, why isn't this funded by the government? You know, like this is the kind of idea that should, like, everything about it makes sense and works and is great. And so I started funding projects like that because I was like, this just makes sense to me. Like, this is the way the world should be. And then after, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years of consistently funding those kinds of projects, then we just explicitly made it our mission statement to support solar because that's what we were doing anyway. Like, at a certain point, it makes sense to just focus on the thing that you know how to do and just move forward with it.
But let me just go back to the because it's just too good to miss that you're in the desert in Chad, and of course all good kind of epiphanies, and I'm going to keep using because you did put that word in writing, so I can't hold you to it. But you know, all good enlightenment kind of comes from trips to the desert, and so you have this sort of dawning, let's call it. And it doesn't have to be an overnight epiphany, and then a big piece of what you're doing is trying to help the people, the planet and the people. So it's kind of, I mean, it feels very religious, but you're not a religious person. In fact, you're the opposite. So what drives it? And I think this is I mean, this is kind of nothing to do with climbing, nothing to do with solar. But I do look for, because I'm also not a believer in any way, religiously, but I try to do the right thing. I really try in my life to be a good person and to work on the right problems and to help people and to, you know, to not just do no evil, but to actually do good. And then I sort of struggle with why, you know, why? I like to post-rationalize. I'm not going to stop doing that, but I would like a rationale. Maybe you can give us a, you know, what's your rationale? What's your answer to that?
I don't think I'm the person to give a good rationale. I mean, call it secular humanism, call it whatever you want, but just a general, like, trying to be a good person, trying to do the right thing. You know, I don't know. It's like, I mean, to me, it stems from a basic sense of fairness, like trying to do something that seems fair. It's like, I don't know. You know, like, I've been dealt a pretty good hand in life, and a lot of people haven't. I'm kind of like, you know, that's not really fair. And so I can at least try to balance the scales a little bit. You know, it's like, I don't know. Trying to, like, yeah, I mean, there's no great answer for it, but it's just, or I mean, you could just take the full selfish explanation of it is that, you know, I sleep better at night knowing that I've tried my best to do something useful. You know, it's like strictly self-interest. I mean, call it whatever you want, but it's just like trying to do the right thing.
Oh, that's the sort of evolutionary biology answer that I feel better, therefore I'm more successful or whatever. No, because I think there is, look, I like I say, I'm not going to stop doing it. I don't have a better answer than what you've just enunciated there. But I do find it fascinating that very often doing good is framed in sort of religious narratives. And actually, the people I meet don't seem overtly religious at all, yet they're doing good things.
Here's a whole random anecdote. Actually, it's a bit of an aside, but it has to do with the beginning of my foundation and like why I care about these kinds of things. But you know, so I've been a professional athlete now for 15 years or something, and my sister, who's a little older than me and like a great person, cares about humanity, very smart. She was a public school teacher for a few years before she basically quit because it was totally heinous in the U.S. It's like kind of hard to be a public school teacher, and now she does like trail work and like forestry projects. Basically, she's a botanist. She like loves the outdoors. It's a whole interesting thing. Anyway, so my sister was working as a public school teacher, making, I don't know, some pittance, you know, like this tiny amount of money. And then I was contacted to shoot this TV commercial where I belayed this woman. It was a Citibank ad where it was focused on this woman who was climbing, and I was just the person in the background holding the rope and sort of supporting her. And it was like a 2 or 3 day shoot. It was super fun. I hung out with the woman who was the model, was like a friend of mine. We're like having a nice time, you know, we're climbing. And then the ad got used all over the world for several years, and we got residuals for it. So every time that it airs, we get paid a little bit. And I was living in my car. I had no overhead. You know, I was like, I have no expenses, like nothing going on. And all of a sudden, you know, I wound up making like 6 figures off that ad, which was like 2 days of work doing nothing. And that I would have done for fun anyway, because it's just such a fun, interesting experience to like shoot this TV ad. And I was like, what a gross, like misappropriation of human resources and time. I was like, I just made, you know, probably three times what my sister makes in a year of educating youth by doing nothing, you know, by like hanging out and shooting a TV commercial. And it's like totally casual. And I was like, it just shows that human society is like grossly misproportioned. I don't know, like, you know, sports and entertainment, like things like that. It's just crazy the amount of money that goes into TV and like music and film and stuff like that, where you're like, why is this worth so much more than educating youth or like repairing society in different ways or protecting the environment or like all these other things that seem more useful in the long term? And yet, you know, if you're a rapper, you're making like this absurd amount of money. You're like, but is rapping really more important than educating kids? You're like, I don't really think so. You know, and so all that to say, a lot of that money went into starting the foundation, because I was basically like, I suddenly am making more than I need and the world seems grossly unfair. This makes no sense. I should be putting this money to something more useful.
Right. And that's, I mean, it's a great story. And it's kind of, you know, you don't need a huge, philosophical rationale to kind of do what's obviously the right thing. The equivalent for me was going to a dinner. I used to do this thing on Twitter, maybe on Instagram, where I did the chandeliers of climate change. And I would take pictures of these beautiful chandeliers at the dinners of various climate conferences. So I was going to this big dinner and it was actually in Ireland, and I was two seats down from the Taoiseach, and I was next to the CEO of the Irish big energy utility. Great, great guys, both of them. And just in the car, I saw a tweet and it said, last night we had a power cut and three of our vulnerable babies died. Surely this shouldn't be happening in this day and age with solar power and so on. And it was an Irish doctor called Dr. Niall Conroy, who had been shuttling between his job in Dublin and a city called Bow in Sierra Leone, where he'd set up a neonatal intensive care unit. And the problem is, as soon as there's a power cut, there's no warmth and there's no oxygen. And they started to have babies dying. So I reached out, and that was the genesis of a project called Project Bow, where we put in a solar and battery system for this neonatal intensive care unit. And I had to raise money to do that. I couldn't do it off my own resources, but we put the money together and we worked with the doctor, and it was kind of all going well until during the pandemic, the batteries ran into technical problems. So we're now actually just about to start embarking on repairing the batteries. Right now it's actually operating off a diesel generator, but these things just hit you like a punch in the guts, and you can't really say no. When you see it, you know what you have to do, right?
Totally. Totally. That strikes particularly close to home, because actually we just had a daughter who was, spent a week in the hospital in the neonatal intensive care unit, because she came out not breathing and it was a whole long thing, and now she's totally fine and it all worked out great. But that's exactly the sort of thing that really makes you appreciate living somewhere with a stable grid, good power, all that. Because it's like, yeah, I mean, the baby was being, you know, fully supported in every way for a week. It's like, you definitely want stable power for that.
Right. And so it was doing that project. We were working with some local partners, and they would sort of, the first design that they made was not big enough to ride through the power outage. And I said, well, that doesn't feel, I do a bit of engineering, and that doesn't feel big enough. And they're like, oh yeah, but if it was big enough, it would be really expensive. And I was like, look, I want the power in this African neonatal unit to be as good as it would be in Kensington. Okay, that's the challenge. And we've not achieved that. So, you know, I have to go back and keep going until we've achieved that. But that's what you want. You want kids, babies everywhere in the world should have the sort of power system, the sort of, you know, the medical care. That's another layer on top. Luckily, that was Dr. Conroy's issue, was the medical care, and he's doing a great job on that. I was only trying to help with the power supply.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly it. Some projects just call to you, and kind of like, if you're able to contribute in some way, you feel an obligation to.
Right. And in fact, that's how I came across your foundation, because I was looking, you know, while I was doing the fundraising for that, I was, you know, hunting around on Google, came across the foundation. Talk to me about, okay, you talked about the origins of the foundation, but, you know, do a little bit of a fast forward to, you know, what have you achieved? I think it was started in 2012. So you've got a decade. And where are you today? How, you know, what are you, what does it look like today?
Yeah. So, Yeah, basically the same idea, but just grown up a little bit. You know, now we have a staff. Last year, we distributed over $1 million in grants to something like 20 different projects around the world. And basically, we support projects exactly like what you're describing, like a hospital in Sierra Leone, let's say. We've done several different schools for indigenous girls and things like that, where it's basically just a grid-tied solar system on the roof of a school. It's, you know, adding a little bit of reliability for their power and reducing their utility costs and just allowing them to put more money back into their actual purpose, which is educating girls. We've had a few projects like that. We've supported projects with solar-powered boats in the Amazon. I mean, in general, and we were just talking about risk. I mean, in general, we're open to riskier projects or sort of innovative projects, like things that might be funding from more mainstream institutional sources. But we're drawn to, you know, good ideas. Like if something seems like it should exist, like, you know, we don't mind failing from time to time. We're happy to support interesting ideas and see where they go. But so each year we issue an open call for grants and then we sift through. We just closed our latest call for grants and there were something like 700 applications, and we winnowed that down to the 20 or so best projects.
Right.
Though if we had triple the funding, we would just fund more projects because there's so many good ideas, but we just don't have the money to support that many.
But I thought I read somewhere that you're hoping to double in the coming year because there's a bit more money coming in, perhaps.
Yeah, there is. I think this year we're hoping to give away 2 million in grants, and we've kind of developed the institutional capacity to probably handle up to 5 million in grants, but we're kind of looking for bigger partners who are, you know, happy to support that kind of thing. I think that over the last few years, I personally felt a little bit shy about going to like the truly mega wealthy or like big institutions, whatever, and asking for that kind of money, just because, you know, I was like, well, who are we? But now at this point, we actually have a pretty proven track record over the last several years. We've been supporting really good projects. We have this huge pipeline of applications. Like basically, there are tons of good ideas that are going unfunded just because we don't have the money for it. And so now I feel pretty comfortable going to bigger foundations or, you know, some wealthy individuals and just asking them to double our budget basically so we can just do double the work. But
Right, and you work through partners, so it's not, you know, you're not out there in the Amazon with the screwdriver on the roof. I mean, you are personally every so often, but the foundation works with local partners. Is that mainly or exclusively?
Almost pretty much exclusively. I mean, kind of the point of the HANA Foundation is to support local partners because it's never up to us to push some idea onto somebody. I mean, we're here to help other people's ideas. It's like if a community, especially because, I mean, as you know, none of these projects work without full community buy-in. I mean, it has to be somebody else's idea that they're implementing, and you're just there to provide, you know, money, sometimes materials, sometimes some technical expertise, sometimes a little bit of, you know, communications advice, things like that. I mean, basically, we're there to help support the project, but if there isn't a community organization that's pushing for the project, then, you know, then we're not going to push it on anybody.
But do you get involved with things like importing solar panels to, you know, Ecuador or to, you know, somewhere in the Himalayas? Because that was a big issue when we did our project in Bo. There was this big risk that we were going to get tax. We were going to have import duties on the solar panels, and we were working with a local partner. But it ended up being a very, very difficult, you know, you don't, how do you budget for a project where you don't know if you're going to get slapped with 30% extra costs or whatever the number is? Do you get involved in that, or is that then the local partner just has to kind of navigate that?
I think it's case by case. It depends. I mean, we want to see the projects that we support succeed. So, I mean, we'll go as far as we can to try to help. I mean, so right now, actually, it's funny you say that with 30% cost increase because we're supporting this project in Puerto Rico. That's the first cooperative solar microgrid on the island. It's like this nonprofit of all the businesses in this village or sort of small city. Sort of banded together as this microgrid. It's the whole city center. It's pretty cool, and it's using sort of second life batteries from electric cars, and
Oh,
it's like an
great.
interesting idea, and it's a really good idea, but it's taken quite a bit longer than we sort of thought it would, and it's way higher budget than we thought it would be. But again, that's kind of the nature of doing something that hasn't been done before. So you're like, well, you know, it's like you couldn't have foreseen these kinds of cost increases, and like you couldn't have foreseen a pandemic happening, and then like the local installer, you know, upcharging this and that. And it's all, yeah. So I mean, that's a project that we've been shepherding along for many years now. And we do basically as much as we can to make it succeed.
Right, so I ended up writing a piece with sort of lessons learned from Project Bow. And I don't think that I didn't get, it wasn't a comprehensive list because there were all these different ways. And, you know, one of them that I definitely anticipated, but we didn't budget enough, was just maintenance costs. That, you know, it's all very well to install these systems, but if they just fall over 2 years later, there has to be money. There has to be somebody visits them. You need, you know, you need to be monitoring the systems via the internet, whatever. That all needs to be paid for, right?
But that's why you really need the community buy-in. That's why you need the community organization that's responsible for the project, who's, you know, I want to say funding the project, though. I mean, they're funding it through money that we're donating through the foundation, but it's like basically their project that they're running. You know, it's like you need someone else to actually be in charge of it who lives there and cares about it.
Right. And reading about some of the stuff you're doing, what was interesting is that it is very focused on the community, but, you know, that's an easy word, but it's actually I look through some of your projects, it tends to be linked to sort of social outcomes. You know, the people are either delivering healthcare or they might be working on something. And so it's kind of, you know, it's very modern in the sense that it's not just here, have a solar system, you know, don't mess it up, goodbye. It's very much working with partners who are trying to achieve some outcomes. Some of them are not, and they're not energy charities. They tend to be around health or gender or inclusion or work or something else.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, the thing is that if we only cared about the environmental impact of solar, like offsetting carbon, then we would just be hoping to finance grid-tied utility scale installations. But the thing is, that doesn't really have any public good. Like, that doesn't really help communities. That just helps some utility shareholder. And, you know, that's not really inspiring to us. That's not useful to local communities. And so, you know, I think the projects that you're describing that wind up helping communities and like real communities in specific ways, those are the projects that we fund just because, as I was saying before, they feel so win-win. You're like, oh, that's such an obvious, it's just so good. You know, you're like, oh, you're using this environmental project to really help this community in a way that makes total sense.
And do you also monitor, you talked about, we don't mind failing that, you know, I can sort of come back at you and say, do you really monitor, you know, commissioning of the project, you know, operation at 1 year, operation at 5 years, do you look for those outcomes, jobs, healthcare outcomes? How much can you do? And, you know, you're making relatively small grants. So it's not like the wrong answer if you say, well, there's only so much we can do.
Yeah, we don't push too hard. And it's hard to say, actually, because our current grant structure has only really existed for the last 2 or 3 years. So we can't really have, you know, 5 year monitoring. And realistically, most of the systems should last for 25 years. So it's going to be quite a while until we really know the long term impacts and how well it's really worked. But no, definitely, you know, our staff member who's in charge of grants, Kate, is amazing. And she does follow up with all the different organizations, which is tough because each year we're bringing in more and more organizations that we're supporting. So it's like each year is like more projects to follow up on. But one of the other slight challenges with that for us for you know, sort of reporting is that a lot of nonprofits sort of report, you know, carbon offsets or things like that, or, you know, they have like some easy metric. But the thing is that the projects that we're supporting are so varied. You know, some are like a grain thresher or like a granary, and another is like a water pump, and another is a solar powered boat, and another is a school. And so there's no obvious metric to compare them all by. And the carbon offset like doesn't really matter for a lot of them, because like a solar powered boat, it's like technically it is reducing the use of diesel fuel, let's say. But the bigger impact is that by having a robust boat network, it means you don't have to cut roads through the forest, which then prevents not only the deforestation of cutting the roads, but then once roads are cut like arteries through the jungle, then it's really easy to have illegal mining and poaching and forestry. And like basically once there are roads in place, then it's really easy for other destructive activities to take place. So, you know, if you can maintain a robust boating network, then it prevents having to build roads, which prevents a whole host of other problems. And it's like, how do you quantify that in your reporting? And realistically, you know, us helping to support that boat project, like, do we take, you know, 1% credit if some road isn't built? Like, you know, who knows? Like, how do you report that? But the thing is, you're doing the right thing and you know that it's like the correct action for the world. It's just hard to report.
Yeah, so you're right. It is incredibly complicated. And in my, you know, day-to-day activities, I spend an awful lot of time talking to people who are trying to measure the impact of investments. Because, of course, you know, that boat that you're talking about, that may enable a kid to go to school. So, and they may end up, you know, being an engineer and installing a lot more solar than you or I ever could. And that's fabulous. They might, of course, not do that. They might do something bad, but also they might just become wealthy and have a higher footprint as a result. And so, you know, these, but it's almost impossible. But as you say, I think the important thing is you just kind of know it's the right thing to do on a human level and also on an environmental level, because at least that community is learning about solar. And so there are all the kind of knock-on, you know, positive impacts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny that you use the example of a kid going to school, because that actually, even before I started my foundation, that was one of the things that always struck me when I was traveling with expeditions, is that you'd see groups of kids. To go back to the first main expedition I did to Chad in Africa, we're in the middle of nowhere, and these little kids would come, they're like herding goats and things, and they would come and watch us climb, and they would basically just sit and watch us climb these spires for the whole day, and then sort of wander back to wherever they lived with their goats. And, you know, they never really spoke to us, and we never saw them eat or drink the whole time. And they would just sit there like in their robes, like kind of hiding from the sun for like 8 hours watching. And I was struck by the fact that any one of those kids, you know, could be an astronaut with the right education, or like they could be the next Einstein or who knows what. But instead, they're almost certainly going to be raising goats in the desert for their entire lives. And not that that's necessarily bad, but I just would want them to have the opportunity to do whatever they're good at. You know, it's like you never know what kind of hidden talents there are in the world. And that is a big part of why I started the foundation, because you just see all these kids all around the world and you're kind of like, man, like what a waste of, or potentially a waste of human potential. Like, I don't know.
No, absolutely. And, you know, you use the word humanism and it's absolutely true, you know, and especially because it's kind of like we're now so much more alert to these issues of talent, the fact that talent is in, you know, the sort of the half of the human race that didn't get to do, you know, top end jobs because they were women. And then you got this, you know, huge racial disparities in even in our own societies. And then you travel to countries and you realize, yeah, they could be astronauts. They might have the answer to the world's environmental problems. You know, they might grow up to be a chemist and learn how to fix nitrogen better.
Sure.
But sitting there and herding goats, you're not going to learn about it.
Or like, that's the kid who's finally going to solve fusion or something, you know, like some like seemingly intractable problem in right. physics that people have been working on forever. And you're like, this is the kid, but too bad he's raising goats.
But you've also done projects, which I found really interesting, in the US. So of a couple of types, as far as I could see, one was there are still people in the US who do not have access to electricity. You know, I was on Sustainable Energy for All, working with the UN Secretary General on the, you know, was 1.2 billion, now it's 800 million people with no electricity. There are still people in the US with no electricity. And then the other sort were urban, disadvantaged, vulnerable communities that have suffered enormous environmental and other discrimination. Talk about what you do in the US.
Yeah, well, so we've always funded projects in the US, and that's partially because on a big picture, I always felt like money abroad went a lot further, but funded sort of smaller projects, like basically would have a smaller environmental impact, but often a much larger human impact. But then some of the grid tied systems in the US would have a much bigger environmental impact in terms of offsetting carbon, but kind of a smaller human impact, because a lot of the projects in the US are really just reducing a low-income family's utility bill, which is tremendously useful for them. But in the grand scheme of things, it's different than somebody abroad having light for the first time. You know, it's like having a reduced utility bill is nice, but like being able to light your home after dark in the tropics is a big deal. So, you know, I felt like the domestic projects we were supporting within the US were typically bigger environmental things, but smaller human impact. But then, like you said, there's a whole host of different projects that we've supported in the U.S. I mean, a lot of the communities that don't have access to power in the U.S. are tribal, like tribal lands, like the Navajo Nation. We've supported a couple different projects with them. And I mean, and that's a whole crazy history that's almost too complicated to get into, like why. But I mean, really, it's probably just fair to say a legacy of racism and mismanagement that have sort of left many communities like that behind. But no, it is insane, because, you know, some of the communities that we've worked on the Navajo Nation, you know, it's like full off grid, no electricity, no anything. And then you can drive 15 minutes and be in some suburban town with like McDonald's and stuff. And you're kind of like, how is it that there are people living in the most rudimentary conditions, like just across the hill? You know, you're like, what? Like, but it's just, yeah, I mean, it's a whole crazy legacy there. But so, you know, it's nice to be able to try to help rectify those issues in a small way.
So you've done some projects with the Navajo Nation, but also some projects in Memphis.
Yeah, the Memphis Rocks, that's a project I'm particularly proud of. So that's an installation we did on Memphis Rocks, which is a nonprofit climbing gym, which is sort of a unique model. And part of the reason that I'm proud of Memphis Rocks is that like the funding for it came from outside of the foundation anyway. Like this is a perfect example of the Hanau Foundation being able to help make something happen in a way that like wouldn't have happened otherwise. Because basically I found an affluent climber who cares about climbing, was looking to do the right thing and help the community. And basically we brought them in, they funded the project on Memphis Rocks, and it all happened. And it's great for Memphis Rocks because Memphis Rocks is more than just a nonprofit climbing gym. They're basically a community organization that does almost anything that you can imagine a community center should. So they're kind of providing food in what's otherwise a bit of a food desert. It's kind of a grim part of town. And providing sort of after school opportunities for youth and including like a food and sort of clothing, what do you even call like sort of shelter, like where you can kind of distribute goods to people who
Well,
need them.
there'd be a food bank for at
Yeah,
least that's what it would be
exactly.
called in the UK, but then the clothing
Yeah.
would be, yeah, I don't know what
Yeah,
you call
like
a
a
clothing
clothing bank
bank.
as well.
Yeah.
But basically Memphis Rocks is an organization that's willing to do anything that's helpful for their local community,
Right.
which is great. I mean, that's the definition of a good community. It's also a great climbing gym. And I as a climber, I went and I climbed with all the kids, and I was like, this is great. This is a really good facility, but it also does so much more for their community. And so for us to put, just a big grid-tied solar system on the roof, saves them a tremendous amount of utility bills, and they can just put that straight back into their community work. And so that's like an obvious win-win for me.
Right, so just talk about the funding model for Honnold Foundation. I mean, obviously you, I'm assuming, are still putting some of your own earnings into it, but that's multiplied through now fundraising. You talked about from individuals and now starting to get into institutions, do you think?
I would love to. I don't think if there are any institutions listening, we're happy to take funding. But no, so far we don't really have any institutional funders. Right now I'm supporting a fair amount. I'm kind of hoping to cover all the overhead, so basically pay everything for staff and fundraising everything. Mostly because my name's on it, so I'd like to support the organization itself, and then hopefully everything else can go to projects. And that just like feels good to me. It's like a nice way to cover things.
Yeah, that really resonates. I've also chaired actually a medical charity, colorectal medicine, and the hardest bit to cover is the central cost, the admin, and the fundraising. Everybody wants to give money to the nice project with the gym and the school in wherever and so
Yeah,
on. Not
exactly.
everybody, but that's fundable. But then when it's like the people working in the office and the connectivity and the travel and the insurance and all that kind of stuff, and then fundraising, nobody wants to fund the fundraising, right? So that's really good that you cover that.
Yeah, that's kind of my current, and that's actually kind of happening this year. I had just been donating quite a bit to the foundation, and then this year I kind of realized that we've grown to the point where there's enough staff. Anyway, it just makes sense for me to try to cover the whole organization, and then everything else can go to projects. It's just like a nice neatness to it that feels right to me. But then we make quite a bit from recurring donors, sort of people who are inspired by the work, or many of them are sort of passionate climbers and things like that who follow me through what I do. And then we also just have a lot of individual donors, like a fair number of. I do a bit of corporate speaking, so I've met a lot of people through like venture capital type talks, like the tech community, things like that. And so there are a few big sort of tech, very successful tech folks who donate quite a bit.
But when you say, if there's anybody, any institutions out there listening, I mean, there really are. We know this because that's the world that I have spent a lot of time in. Now, what will be really interesting would be if they contact you after this episode goes out, because there are certainly, all sorts of people. I don't want to name them on air because I'll embarrass them then if they don't become major donors to you. But there are people. I mean, there's, and of course you've got, there's folks like Jeff Bezos. He's putting 10 billion
Totally.
into climate and environmental
Well,
action.
so what I'm kind of hoping is that for anybody listening, consider this a direct appeal. What I think that the Hanau Foundation does really well that a lot of other climate nonprofits don't do is the human side, the helping real communities improve the quality of their lives in some way, because so much climate funding is going towards sort of carbon removal projects and sort of like moonshot technology plays and things like that. And I'm like, and I'm fine with that. I mean, I think there's a real space for developing the technologies of the future and sort of like climate venture capital, all that stuff. I'm like, that's fine, but that's not helping the quality of human lives. And especially for something like the Earth Fund, like the Jeff Bezos Fund, if you're listening, actually, I met him once, had dinner with him. It was charming dinner, it was lovely. But if I ever see him again, I am going to basically pitch him exactly on this, because if he's donating $10 billion to climate, the bulk of that money is going to trying to fund new technologies and all those kinds of things. And for a tiny fraction of that, you can have this tremendous human impact where, you know, many, many human lives are positively affected. It's like, that's what I think the Hanna Foundation can do well.
So I said I wasn't going to embarrass anybody. I don't know if Jeff Bezos will ever hear this, but I'll almost be sure that Andrew Steer and Charlotte Pera, who run the Bezos foundation, or the Bezos Earth Fund, I'll be pretty sure they'll listen at some point. And if they're not listening, I will send them a link and I will urge them to listen.
You
did this great pitch, because I was kind of leading you earlier, saying you seem to be doing things that are really centered in the community and the outcome in terms of the broader aims of the community: employment, transportation, health, inclusion, etc. And you know, you're absolutely right. The big controversy that's going on now in the offset world, it's not even the controversy is starting, but it's going to get worse, is these big companies, they want to plant trees. But, you know, in what they want to do in some cases is kind of chase all the people out of the way so that they can plant the trees. So they're not really measuring by the outcomes of the people. There's 26 million people already live in the Amazon, right? What are they supposed to do, in terms of, you know, whether it's you can eliminate deforestation, but it's got to take their development and their priorities into account. And that's mirrored everywhere.
Yeah, well, that's why we support so many projects with indigenous rights sort of things, with like schools for indigenous girls and, you know, solar powered boats. And basically, because there are a lot of ways to protect the Amazon by empowering the local communities, which is realistically a more long term way of protecting the Amazon anyway, because if the people who live there are powerful enough to protect their own land, I mean, that's the real way to protect the forest. You know, it's like that kind of thing is always better from within than from without.
Mm-hmm. I did some work actually with Prince Charles more than a decade ago. He had this the rainforest HRH's Rainforest Trust, and it was, and the single thing we came up with that could help most was land rights. Mm-hmm. If the people who benefit from the land own the rights, not the farmers, not the state, not the government, not nobody, but somebody, they tend to look after it. But so, in terms of sort of segueing from the question of funding, just coming back to the climbing, I mean, you're going to keep climbing, I guess the question is, to do the most good in the world, should you now sort of slowly do less climbing and more work with the foundation, or should you do more climbing and earn more money so that you can grow the foundation? You know, do you have that thought? Do you ask yourself those questions?
Yeah, I definitely do think about that. And I actually think that the answer is sort of in the middle, but skewing more towards climbing. Basically, because I'm, you know, not to be douchey, but I'm a pretty good climber, but I'm not a great, you know, climate policy expert or anything like that. You know, I technically, other than reading a lot of books about this and thinking about it and whatever else, I haven't, you know, I technically have no education on the subject. And so, you know, and basically, I think that using my platform as a climber is the most useful thing that I can do. And so, interestingly, last winter, I went on a National Geographic TV show expedition to Guyana, to the rainforest, to climb this particular wall. And we were there with a ecologist, like this biologist, Dr. Bruce Means. And while we were there, he discovered 5 or 6 new species of frog. He was basically there to survey the certain area to find these new species. And so it was a really interesting trip. We climbed this new wall. We succeeded in, you know, the climbing goal. But more importantly, the scientists found 5 or 6 new species. And, you know, hopefully that'll help with conserving, you know, sort of protecting this area in some way. And it's all part of this TV special, which is actually, it turned out pretty good, which I was pleasantly surprised by, because it's not easy to make a climbing expedition like that into watchable television. But the special turned out quite good. And it's showing on Earth Day on National Geographic this year. And, you know, I was like, to me, that's kind of a perfect way of highlighting sort of the wonder of the natural world and the need for protection of this particularly vulnerable forest, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so I'm doing another project like that this summer in Greenland, with more specifically tied to climate science and glaciology, climbing some walls and sort of doing a little research along the way.
That's great. You could be like sort of, you know, the David Attenborough, but with like climbing shoes and rappelling gear and that kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, honestly, you know, you're joking, but if that was useful, I'd be happy to. You know what I mean? Because like, I love traveling and exploring and adventuring and climbing, all those things. But if I can do it in a way that's slightly more useful, then power to it.
So I've actually been in Guyana, but only about 5 feet inside it, because I have a considerably less stellar climbing career than you. But I did climb a tepui called Roraima, which is between Venezuela, Guyana, and Brazil, and I went up that.
Yeah, so we were climbing a tepui called Waiasapu, which is right next to Roraima. So if you remember the summit of Roraima, if you looked, you know, down and east a little bit, there was like a little tepui below you. So we climbed that one, which had never been climbed before. And so we were completing this sort of elevational transect of the river basin between Roraima and the tepui next to it.
Oh, very cool. Because we did see these little frogs, which apparently existed nowhere else. For those who, anybody listening who doesn't know what a tepui is, it's this sort of plateau that has been left at about, what, it's kind of like 2,500 meters, so 10,000, yeah, exactly. 9,000 feet, something. And the rest of the land has sunk right down, and some species have been just left stranded on these islands in the jungle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that's what makes them such ecological hotspots, because each tepui, even though they're only, you know, a kilometer apart as the crow flies, they've been separated by millions of years. So the species on the summit of each tepui are completely distinct. And then the species at the base of the tepui in the cloud forest are also distinct from the species down in the rainforest below. And so you wind up with like this total variety of life, even though everything is technically pretty close together.
That's right. They're kind of like the Galapagos Islands,
yeah, exactly.
The mountains. And as you hike in through the Grand Sabana, you go through all these different levels and layers of different biomes. It's an incredible education, frankly, and a privilege to have been there.
Yeah, we came from the other side, so we were just in full jungle the whole time. There was no Grand Sabana because we were coming more from the north, like down through. It was 10 days of just traipsing through the jungle. It's like pretty full on.
Okay. And then I suppose I have to ask you, though, are you going to be taking, we're going to get back to this question of risk, and I think this is the final question we'll have time for. Is your perception of risk going to change? You've now got your daughter, June, that was born February this year. So I guess it's kind of like happy 1 month and a bit birthday. Is your perception of risk, do you think, going to change?
I don't know. I'm totally open to it changing. I mean, everybody asks, everybody, you know, it's the obvious thing that it might change. So far, it doesn't seem like it has necessarily, but we'll see. I don't know. I kind of hope it doesn't change too much, because the thing is, I've never really felt like I'm taking wild risks. I mean, I've always tried to mitigate risk as much as possible, prepare as much as possible, and then do things as carefully as I can. So I would assume that I'm going to take roughly that same approach. What I could see potentially changing is losing a little bit of the fire to sort of achieve things in climbing. You know, and I've always kind of worried that by having a wife, by having a stable home life, by, you know, basically by being relatively happy, that I just won't be quite as driven to sort of achieve things in climbing. You know, but it's hard to say, because actually last year was kind of one of my bigger years for doing stuff as a climber. And, you know, and that was like with my wife and her being pregnant for half the year. And I don't know. So, I mean, we'll just see.
Now, certainly in my case, I used to take some risks skiing. I was always very careful. I wasn't remotely out there, but it was clear that there were things that had high consequence, you know, like, as you talked about, stuff that I felt very sure on my skis, but it would have been really ugly had it gone wrong. I kind of don't do that anymore. I got three kids, but I'm older than you. I'm 58. I sort of feel like, you know, and I was never the greatest skier in the way that you're up there with the greats in climbing, but I can be pretty good as a climate policy analyst, I'd like to think.
Yeah, so here's, this is a sort of longer answer, and this is something I've been thinking about. I do this other podcast called Climate Vision. It kind of doesn't matter, but so I've had a couple conversations with people recently about Jane Goodall.
You can plug it.
Well, it doesn't matter. I mean, the point is, so I've been like chatting about Jane Goodall a couple times recently, and you know, she's in her 80s, and she apparently works and travels and does events and basically speaks, you know, something like 300 plus days a year. Because she's all in on climate, you know, conservation, sort of protecting the natural world. And It was interesting because, and you know, I don't know Jane Goodall, so this is all total speculation. But my sense from talking to some people who have worked with her on some things is that she's kind of embraced the fact that she's Jane Goodall and just gone all in. You know, where she's like, even though it's harder for her personal life, it's like not very relaxing. I mean, she's in her 80s, it must be exhausting. But you know, she's kind of taken the fact that she is this icon for conservation and used it to the best of her ability to do something useful in the world. And I actually have a lot of respect for somebody who's hasn't necessarily chosen that. You know, it's not that she necessarily wants that or that it's the easiest path, but she's like, look, I am this woman and I have this opportunity and I am obligated to use that as much as possible. And so when you ask about risk taking, I mean, like not that I'm anything like Jane Goodall, but there is a certain point where you're like, if you're pretty good at a specific thing and you have this opportunity to take it as far as you possibly can, in some ways, even if it's not the easiest or most fun thing, or even if you'd rather spend more time with your family or do whatever else, I feel like there's a certain obligation to just do the thing that you're good at as far as you can take it, because that's where you can have the biggest impact in the world. And so, you know, like with the questions about risk and the questions about what I'm doing with the foundation and things like that, I am kind of like, you know, I have an opportunity to do something here. I should take it as far as I can. And that might mean taking some risks, which is fine.
Right. And, you know, it's funny because as I look at the kind of the top level skiers that I used to compete against, get beaten by, hang out with, there were kind of two sorts. There were sorts that when they retired, they went off, had a good, happy life, had some kids, ran a bar. You know, you could barely recognize them as a, you know, aspirational, driven, aggressive people if you met them again. And then there's the other sort who are like, okay, I can't ski World Cup moguls anymore, but I'm going to do something. I'm just going to be just as driven, just as on it, just as all in as you described it. And you know, I personally, I feel like that's the way to be. And whatever it takes to continue to engage like that is what you have to do.
Yeah, I mean, you only have one life. It's like you may as well use as much as you can, I guess. I mean, that said, though, I mean, I suppose if you're the kind of person that wants to relax and just have a good time with your family, like that's fine. That's all great. I just personally feel like there's a lot to be done in the world, and you may as well do as much of it as you can.
Very good. Alex, it's a huge pleasure and an honor talking to you. I think on that final closing thought, we're going to need to end. We're out of time. You know, I wish you the best in your professional life. I feel bad saying that because it's like not the best is sort of like so catastrophic. But I mean, clearly, I wish you the absolute best with everything you do. And also, perhaps especially the foundation, because that resonates so close to my heart. So thank you for spending time with me.
No, I appreciate the opportunity to chat about everything, and definitely send the link to the folks at the Bezos Earth Fund. You know, just pass this along, because we have a huge pipeline of projects that we would love to fund if we had anybody willing to help us. So, you know, just put that out there.
Okay, well, we will add links in the show notes. I've already selected a few, and if there's anything that you would like to add, but we'll put a link specifically to your fundraising pages because you know the ask is very clear, and I can endorse it from what you're saying. You know, it is the exact right approach, so we'll definitely do that.
Cool. Well, I really appreciate that. And yeah, pleasure chatting, and enjoy your Swiss evening.
Thank you very much. Okay,
Yeah,
yeah,
cool.
good night.
Have a good night. Cheers.
So that was Alex Honnold, climate extraordinaire and philanthropist. And that brings to an end season five of Cleaning Up. We'll be back with season six starting in May. Now, previous seasons of Cleaning Up have featured Tony Blair, the former UK Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, the former Prime Minister of Australia, Teresa Ribera, the actual current Deputy Prime Minister of Spain, and Ban Ki-moon, the former Secretary General of the United Nations. So I can guarantee you don't want to miss the first episode of season six of Cleaning Up, which will air on the 4th of May. Until then, I'm going to wish you a happy Easter and all the best from me, Michael Liebreich, and the team behind Cleaning Up. Cleaning Up is brought to you by the Liebreich Foundation and the Gilardini Foundation.